Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hello, I'm Helen.
Hello, I'm Stephen.
And welcome to the New Statesman podcast.
So let's talk about Labour conference, which I don't know about you, but I am stoked about starting on Saturday. Does it start on Saturday? That's a kind of great question, isn't it? Like, who's the first Prime Minister, which gets history graduates really angry?
Yeah, I'm not gonna get involved in who the first Prime Minister is.
Because it was Robert Peel.
No, I think... Yeah, I think it's well worn. I think it has to be Walpole. He effectively introduced and codified stable parliamentary government. He was the architect of a political system which endured to a greater or lesser extent, at least until Pitt the Younger. And I think I can't see an argument that Pitt the Younger was not a prime minister. Now, I don't think you can start with Robert Peel. And I'm not being drawn into this argument.
It's okay, because as soon as you said Pitt the Younger, I started thinking about Brad Pitt, so I would happily... We could talk about Brangelina's divorce if you want, but instead, let's talk about another split that's capturing headlines. The Labour Party. In your big confident prediction-ometer, do you think that Jeremy Corbyn will be elected with a bigger mandate, an enormous mandate, a bigger mandate than last time?
Definitely. I mean, I think partly because Owen Smith has run such a woeful campaign, right? So the interesting thing, to give readers a sneak peek of something I'm going to write after the result, if it is, as I expect, a bigger win for Corbyn than he got last time, right? In some ways, it's actually quite alarming, right? Owen Smith had no profile when he started running. I am yet to meet anyone who honestly thinks Owen Smith has improved his standing over the course of this leadership race.
There are not a lot of pro-Owen Smith voters. There are only anti-Corbyn voters.
Yes, and yet more people will have paid £25 and voted for Owen Smith than voted for Liz Kendall in total. More people will have voted for... So he for a fairly rubbish candidate, he's going to do fairly well, suggesting that if they had someone who actually could inspire some people, could maybe recruit people on their own bat as opposed to just being not Jeremy Corbyn, then you can see how Corbyn would have reason to be worried. Of course, it feels to me unlikely than his critics will produce a candidate who's capable of doing all of those things, because the problem with unity candidates is the subtitle of unity candidate is not someone so good that they will be in power for a long time, right?
Yeah, I keep thinking about the popes. And there was a whole period of popes, right, where no one could really agree and the College of Cardinals was incredibly split. So what they would do is pick the oldest, dodgiest looking pope they could, and the sort of basically that would just be like, well, he'll only be around for like 6 months, which backfired spectacularly with Pope, I'm going to get this wrong, John the 23rd, who then introduced the Second Vatican Council, which took the Mass out of Latin, which is not something that Owen Smith is going to get the chance to do, because he is not... He's not that sufficiently a weak enough a unity candidate, I guess, that people felt okay about voting for him. I just don't think he ever made the case to Corbyn voters who were a bit wary of Corbyn, maybe not amazingly that well. But I think the Corbyn team did very well at saying this will be the counter-revolution, right?
Yeah.
The rebels thought they were there, put up a soft left candidate to say, don't worry, this guy will be just like Corbyn, but better at organising stuff and running stuff. And what people heard was the Corbyn experiment will be stone dead on day one.
Yeah, and he also then, I mean, the problem is he also did then make competence his dividing line and promptly threatened to knock Theresa May on her heels, say he negotiate with ISIS. I mean, it is a really interesting example of one of the things that a lot of people always say is, oh, you know, he needs better staff, et cetera, et cetera. Actually, that campaign has been astonishingly well-staffed, right? It's got a lot of people who are fairly impressive behind the scenes. Their message, press releases, venues, you know, they've had events around the country. It's actually a Rolls-Royce operation. It's just, it doesn't matter if you have a Rolls-Royce operation if your driver is a chimp.
The thing I've been struggling to a concise way of saying, and I haven't got to yet, so the podcast is the correct venue for this thought, I guess. My worry if I were a Corbyn supporter would be a bit like the same worry that I would have if I were a UKIP supporter, which is that the party is in danger of becoming too much a one-man band, which was always the criticism of UKIP, that it was the Nigel Farage show, and they hadn't built any, you know, institutional memory around him. I mean, this wasn't helped by the fact that Nigel Farage sort of, with almost Gordon Brown-like sniper accuracy, picked off anybody who looked like they might threaten him, right? But that would be my worry, is about the sort of succession planning and about the institutional takeover of all the bits and pieces that you need to have a post-Corbyn left-wing party, if that's what you want. How secure that victory is, or how much of it is invested personally in the human being of Corbyn himself.
Well, the interesting thing about the Labour Party is no faction has ever survived a contested leadership election. You can have an interesting and fairly arid argument about the extent to which there was continuity and discontinuity between Blair and Brown, but the leadership election immediately after was won by someone promising a break from the new Labour approach, and effectively the party was run from Labour's soft left for 5 years. Then 2015, the soft left lost control, and the Labour left took control. My instinct is that pattern will continue after election defeat again, but if there's a snap election, then I think Corbyn will get to stay on. So I think if there's a Labour an election defeat in 2017, I think my impression, from talking to our listeners and to talking to party members more generally, is that people will decide.
I think he needs more time. I think that's the thing, is that, you know, I think people feel, and Owen Smith himself was sort of nudging towards acknowledging this, that the coup kind of coming after the EU referendum and then the leadership, after only having a year, I think if their premise was that Corbyn has failed, lots of people didn't feel that they had enough evidence, and they felt that he hadn't been given a chance. And I think that was ultimately pretty toxic to them. And I think if there were an election within the next year, people would probably argue the same thing. Well, you know, this isn't really a Corbyn party yet, so how can we, you know, pin this result on Corbyn? Which I personally is not a thesis that I sign up to, but it is one that is very attractive and I think a lot of people would subscribe to.
I mean, I think I both sign up to it and don't sign up to it, right? On the one hand, do I believe that if the Labour Party unified around Jeremy, they would win? No, of course not. I mean, look at the local elections. Look at everything we know about how people vote, his own personal approval ratings, etc., etc. And also the fact that he will never get over the electoral halitosis of the anthem thing, which is one of those things which shouldn't matter, but people care about it a great deal.
It'll be like stabbed your brother in the back, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And this is the thing. I think that something I'm kind of increasingly want to make clear to people is that for people, particularly people who've only recently got interested in Labour, this is not, you know, not all of this stuff is new, right? Mm. That Labour leaders getting really dragged in the press for things that they, you know, that for single instance getting built up. That is not a new thing. I mean, do you remember Gordon Brown wrote a letter back to a soldier's mother and he was criticised for spelling the name wrong. And there was no taking into consideration the fact that he's only got the use of one eye, you know, he's and the fact that he does this anyway, despite, you know, having to write in marker pen, was, you know, I think is quite a thoughtful thing to do. But no, that doesn't matter. Yeah, that doesn't matter. That's still a front page headline about disrespect to our troops. And that, you know, and the Emily Man and the bacon sandwich, you know, the press is not fair to people who are not in a position to give it favours.
Also, the press is not fair to the left. And one of the things which was really interesting during the referendum campaign is talking to Conservative cabinet ministers who were on the side of Remain. Several of them, I mean, one of them did explicitly say, gosh, it's quite hard being on the left, isn't it? But several of them did suddenly go, oh, wait a second. You don't get a fair hearing for this. This is much harder.
And there was a certain kind of almost sort of schadenfreude among some senior Labour figures who were like, oh, right, so, you know, watch these guys having to play politics on not the easy difficulty setting. Right?
But yeah, the difficulty is, of course, So while I don't buy that if people had unified behind him, he would have won, unquestionably he will do worse because people aren't unified behind him, right? You know, just because I think the building is on fire doesn't change the fact that turning all of the taps on the bottom floor hasn't created another problem.
Okay, so what do you think is going to happen about the shadow cabinet? And also, can you tell me what happened at the NEC election last night? Because it was magazine press day and I was reading proofs rather than paying attention to the 8.5 hour NEC meeting.
So it was high noon at the NEC meeting, right? Now, the interesting thing is that this is like the lame duck NEC. The new NEC will take power after conference. The NEC is elected broadly in thirds. I'm going to simplify slightly here for ease of explanation, right? So it's elected by affiliates, so trade unions, Fabian Society, all of that jazz, who elect various representatives onto their bit, by MPs, by the shadow cabinet, and so not third, so fourth, and by and the what's it face? The members, right?
Yeah, I was the Welsh.
So a lot of people got slightly confused because people were reporting that Corbynites swept the board, right? They did, but
they're only a bit of the board.
So it's basically like the old electoral college. It's like if you won every vote in the state of California or whatever, you still only get however many electoral college votes.
Yeah.
So they got six candidates elected to the NEC.
That's that was the momentum slate, But also, did I hear something about them having now representatives from the national parties, the Welsh and the Scottish parties?
So Karen Jones, the leader of the Welsh Party, and Keir Dugdale, the leader of Scottish Labour, will both now have seats on the NEC. In addition,
I think it's fair to describe both of them as not. Yeah, Corbyn skeptics, right? I think both of them have said publicly they are, you know, they're not. Well,
the interesting thing is Karen Jones has stayed completely silent about the leadership election, which is a fun bit of Welsh Labour criminology.
I don't think either of them are overly keen to get involved in it, but here's the way of putting it. Neither of them are Corbyn fans, right? They are not the type of MP who would have nominated him in the first place, right? They're not from that part of the party.
Yeah, and also, I mean, the interesting thing is there is not a formal position of leader of the Welsh Labour Party. There's just a leader of the Welsh parliamentary group, as it were, in the assembly. So
so that could be Neil Hamilton as well.
But so in another way, in term, yeah, it makes it harder for them to get through rule changes. And while pro Corbyn candidates did well among the membership, they did worse among the parliamentary party. So oh God, what's his trousers?
For listeners who were wondering that Stephen sounds a little vague, you were glugging Lemsip mere moments for this. And as you admitted this morning, there is somebody who spreads conference flu to everybody, and Typhoid Mary is you this year, right? You are going to go to the New Statesman party on Sunday and breathe on MPs. Maybe we'll get you one of those little shields.
But the good thing is it means there's always someone at Conservative Party conference who, when every other journalist who's been there is like, I feel awful. He's like, I feel great. Because obviously they've passed it on to everyone else. So I am going to be the person in Birmingham.
Chipper. Yeah.
Happy.
Can we just talk quickly about the subject of my column this week, which is English nationalism? So the premise that I've been exploring is this idea that those Northern Labour heartlands, there are working class voters, primarily white voters, who describe themselves on an interesting scale called the Merino scale as more English than British. And that's and 80% of voters who describe themselves that way voted Leave in the EU referendum. And that's also the group with whom UKIP does well.
So this whole time you've been talking about Merino, I thought you were talking about
the Jose Merino scale. No, tragically not. It is a Spanish political scientist, and it was a question that was formed to gauge in support for Catalan independence, I think. But what's kind of quite interesting about that is that those voters do not see, there is no English Labour Party, right? And I think, you know, you and I have talked about the interesting resilience and now challenges of Welsh Labour, and I think that there is a distinctively Welsh flavour of the Labour Party that does well. Obviously, Scottish Labour, another thing that came out of the NEC meeting last night is that Kezia Dugdale has got much more control over that party now, right? Over CLPs, over candidate selections. Yeah. So they are trying to rebuild Scottish Labour as a distinct force in its own right. Well, that leaves then, what is there an English Labour Party, and how does that appeal to people who see themselves primarily as English? So if you look at the Merino scale, people describe themselves from, I am English, not British. I'm more English than British. I'm equally, and Labour support goes up the more people see themselves as British. And I spoke to John Denham, a former Labour MP who now researches Englishness, and he said, Scotland in the EU referendum campaign got Scotland stronger in Europe. England got Britain stronger in Europe. And that was a problem, because that was an elite campaign from people who think that Britain and England are the same thing. And actually, because England is such a dominant identity and it's such a dominant, demographically, there's always been resistance to an English parliament. But how do you reach those voters who feel themselves to be English and feel that Labour is not English?
So I'm really sceptical about this English Labour thing, right? So Bridget Phillipson, who is an MP, who I think is hugely, I think underrated would be the wrong word. She went on maternity leave during the Labour leadership, which I think is a time when a lot of people, like, say, Chion Wurra, was suddenly writing lots of interesting things, and people kind of noticed her and took account of her as a kind of a thinker, the same with, say, Johnny Reynolds or Alison McGovern. And I think Bridget Phillipson is another person who kind of could have come up in that space.
Well, that's going to be one of the great things that you and I can write about in our memoirs, the great maternity leave change of Labour, right? How it's the sort of butterfly effect. Rachel Reeves's maternity leave, Lisa Nandy's maternity leave, that meant that, one of the reasons that she didn't stand for leader was that she had a very small child.
Yeah.
And still does. I mean, the child is now marginally larger, but not huge.
Yeah, no, it's not young enough. It's not old enough to, stand for Parliament or whatever. But Bridget Phillipson wrote a brilliant piece, unfortunately for Labourists, not for us, which I'm still angry about. But in which he kind of made the point, well, what would this English Labour Party do, right? The reason why there's a Scottish Labour Party is because there is a Scottish Parliament and they stand candidates to. Ditto Wales. Labour didn't get rid of, the Berkshire Labour Party because it hates Berkshire. It's because that county count, that local authority doesn't exist anymore. People dislike the Labour Party in parts of England, right? Because Labour, for a very long time, has not done very well in places where W.H. Smith is the only bookshop, in places where most people are employed by the private sector, in most kind of small towns with fairly identical looking high streets. It actually does badly in those places which are like Wales. I think a lot of the people it does badly with identify more as English than British, but I'm not really convinced that my instinct is the reason why Labour does well with people who identify as British is because people who identify as British, not English, are more likely to be minorities, who are now the most reliable part of Labour's coalition, right? It's basically metropolitan lefties of various hues and ethnics, right? That is Labour's coalition. I feel like the Englishness thing feels a little bit like, I don't know, if Labour's like in a spaceship and there's like a cracked window and like the oxygen is running out, and someone going, oh God, the problem is the window's not stained glass. No, the problem is there's a massive crack in it. It just happens that it also doesn't have a stained glass window.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a question that we probably need to pay more attention to. It's not something I kind of managed to go into, given the space allowed, about how much Englishness in that context is a proxy for white, actually. And that's a really complicated question. And I think it's probably one that merits quite a sort of long, sober analysis. I mean, I think John Denham said to me that 70% of people describe themselves as white English, so you can't say it's as simple as if you say you're English, that's because you're racist or because you're a white supremacist or, any of those things. But it clearly is, I think there is this interesting dynamic developing where particularly, actually a lot of white men in particular, and I'm sure, white women as well, see affirmative action programs, but see the way that people have talked about minorities as needing kind of special help and special recognition. And they kind of feel, my life's not great, where's that force for me? And I think that's something that, Labour can appeal to that in terms of its old-fashioned socialist collectivist message about the idea about working together and by class-based kind of endeavour. But it's something that people are very queasy about engaging with, which doesn't necessarily mean you shouldn't engage with it, because there is clearly something there. It just means it has to be done quite carefully, I think.
Yeah.
Well, it's good. We're in total agreement. If anybody still doesn't have anything to do, exciting to do on Sunday lunchtime, Stephen and I will be talking with all our reaction to the Labour leadership election. We're talking about how Owen Smith's surprise victory has overwhelmed us, and our reaction to that at the King's Place podcast festival on Sunday. If you just Google that and our names, you will find it. And there are a couple Actually, there really aren't very many tickets left, but there are like 6 or so tickets left. So if you are free on Sunday, come and see us.
Hi, I'm Caroline.
And I'm Anna.
And together we host the New Statesman's pop culture podcast, Seriously. If this sounds like something you'd be interested in, you can get this episode and everything else we've done on newstatesman.com/SRSLY.
And now it's time to go down the line, not to the lobby, of course, because it's conference season, but to hear the latest developments from Lib Dem conference in Brighton with George.
Hi, Stephen.
Hi, George.
So, yes, as you say, the nation came to a stunning halt this week for the Lib Dem conference, and their leader, Tim Farron, made his closing speech yesterday. And what was politically notable about it was Farron's attempt to reposition himself as a centrist. So when he was elected in July 2015, which, as he pointed out, makes him now the longest-serving leader of a UK-wide party, he pitched himself to the left of Labour. The Lib Dems, for instance, voted against the welfare reform bill, while Labour, of course, abstained. He opposed intervention in Syria at the time. Then, of course, we had the election of Jeremy Corbyn. And so what left-wing space there was to the left of Labour previously was monopolised. And so Farron is now pitching for those centrist voters who don't like Corbyn's direction. And the striking lines in the speech were on Tony Blair. And so Farron said, there were obviously things I didn't like about Tony Blair's government, Iraq, 90-day detention. But I liked his early work. He compared him to the Stone Roses, saying I preferred their early stuff. The minimum wage, tax credits, public service investment. And he said Blair was someone who recognised you need to get stuff done in politics. And I don't think Jeremy Corbyn cares about winning. And so that was quite striking in that you certainly won't hear such kind words said about Tony Blair from any Labour conference speaker. And I also thought it was interesting that although Farron praised former Lib Dem leaders, Paddy Ashdown, he praised Vince Cable in his speech, he praised Charles Kennedy. He had nothing to say about Nick Clegg and nothing, very little to say about the Lib Dems' own past record in government. So it's come to something when you think that citing Tony Blair in your speech is a better political move than citing Nick Clegg.
I mean, in an odd way, kind of, the gap between Farron and Clegg has always been overstated, partly because Farron has briefed it fairly hard over his career. But Clegg is still adored among the Lib Dem rank
yes.
and file, which I think was one of the interesting things at Brighton. You know, kind of he packed out one of the rooms for his book signing. And in many ways, praising Blair is something Farron has been doing privately for some time, yeah, certainly for a number of years. Will the fact that he ran to the left for the coalition years mean that this latest kind of transformation won't work, or you know, is it going to lead to a transformation of the Liberal Democrat brand and appeal?
Mm. Well, the big struggle that the Lib Dems face is simply that of relevancy. They only have 8 MPs. Of course, that's the same number as Northern Ireland's DUP. I think what they really need to recover is to rebuild on a local level, and they are enjoying some good council by-election results, and for the Tories to suffer really an absolute calamity in government, because the Lib Dems, like Labour, tend to thrive when their main opponents, who are the Conservatives, are in trouble. And it's in those seats where the Lib Dems are still the natural opposition, where they're still in second place, where they can hope to make advances. The other flank on which Farron hopes to succeed, of course, is Brexit. So he's taken the most Europhile position of any party leader, calling for a referendum on the eventual Brexit deal. And if that comes to be seen, if the Leave vote comes to be seen as a mistake by a majority of the general public, he hopes the Lib Dems will benefit from that, not least because Jeremy Corbyn has accepted Brexit, some claim, because he desired it, and isn't calling for another referendum of any kind.
He's already having some problems with that line, though, isn't he? I mean, I was on a panel where Norman Lamb warned against trying to overturn the result. Vince Cable has warned against it. Another Lib Dem grandee, whose name temporarily escapes me, has. Yeah, so is there trouble ahead for Tim Farron?
Yes, you may think the Lib Dems are too small to have a split, but the EU question proved otherwise. And there is a risk that the Lib Dems were rejected at the last election, partly because they were seen as elitist, establishment, out of touch. And this call to Farron hopes reverse the outcome of the referendum risks being seen as undemocratic by some of them. Of course, it's not. But you're right, the politics are potentially tricky for him.
Yeah. And of course, he has the problem that he only has to disagree with one of his MPs to have lost an eighth of his parliamentary party. That joke has been done to death, hasn't it? Anyway, we will be back next week.
This is a Manhattan-bound B Express train. The next stop is Grand Street.
Mind the gap.
Hi, I'm Stephanie.
And I'm John. And we host Skylines, a City Metric podcast, where every 2 weeks we talk about cities, maps and the human world.
Whether the Olympics are good for cities, what it's like to be a woman in a city. And we've had guests like Lauren Elkin, Caroline Criado-Perez.
And Neil Codling, the keyboard player from Suede, because I'm nearly cool now.
Tune in on iTunes or on Acast.
Check it out.
And now welcome to a section called You Ask Us, in which you ask us questions. You can always tweet us at Helen Lewis, at Stephen Kibbe. Stephen now has a Facebook fan page with probably lots of pictures of you on it, I'm guessing.
It actually has only a couple of pictures of me and also a picture of the bread that I made on my Delia column.
So that's just a bonus, really, for free there. The question this week is about Bernie Sanders, beloved of the American left. Would he have done better than Hillary Clinton? I think there's a moment, basically everyone in America, all the American liberals, right, are now freaking out because, and actually really interested in Brexit because they're like, what if this is our Brexit? You know, basically everyone goes, we've looked at this, all the experts overwhelmingly think that Trump is really unqualified, says mad things, has no temperamental interest, has some really quite intriguing financial arrangements, his donations to charity, the way that he's used his foundation. And, you know, lots of experts saying that this is a terrible choice. And then people going, so that's my choice because I hate experts. Do you think that Hillary Clinton is, as a candidate, is ill-equipped to deal with that? And would Bernie Sanders have been better?
Yes and no, right? There are many problems with Hillary as a candidate. She has a tendency to make these weird, unforced errors. So like when she said that the Reagans had started a conversation on gay rights during the primary.
At the time when it turns out they were passing anti-gay laws.
Yeah, and it's one of those things you're just like, but you weren't, if she'd done that on an interview and someone said, like, she's just died, and you're just like, oh God, what do I need to say, right? You go, that's a gaffe, but I at least understand it. But that was a planned statement. The emails where, now, I think in terms of the stuff Trump has done and the level of coverage the email scandal has got, that has been slightly disproportionate. But at every point the campaign, yeah, and the pneumonia again, at every point, just go, I've got pneumonia. Just kill the story.
I think that's the idea. I think the problem is they knew they were working from a starting point that people see her as slightly shifty and dishonest, which is kind of interesting because PolitiFact fact-checked her and found her, that, you know, in terms of the statements that she says about politics, to be incredibly honest, unusually honest as a candidate. Whereas, well, if you can work out what Donald Trump's policies are from one day to the next, right? You know, where and there are several things where he has flat out lied, such as saying that he was against the Iraq war from the start, or that he wasn't, you know, he gave up talking about birtherism years ago, and you can, you know, just things that are just provably untrue.
Yeah.
But she knows that's the narrative that she's fighting against. My issue with Bernie is, what I don't understand, so I on Facebook, I remember lots of Bernie and Jeremy Corbyn groups because I want to kind of keep in touch with what people are saying. And people are now sort of sad with Bernie that he's not more anti-Clinton, which I think is a kind of fascinating trope. He did he's done some really great tweets and speeches about how, you know, yes, he had a different vision to Hillary Clinton, but for God's sake, why would you let Trump in if you're on Bernie's side? I think he's actually been not loyal to her exactly, but he's certainly been much more pragmatic than a lot of his supporters want him to be.
Oh yeah, he's been a very impressive presence on the campaign. The reason why I think Bernie wouldn't have done better is, in some ways, the problem with the candidate field in the primaries, right, is you had one candidate who could not appeal to the young and young graduates, kind of one half, yeah, well, not a half, as we saw from the fairly lopsided result, but yeah, basically 30 to 40% of the Democratic coalition. And Hillary Clinton just could not appeal to that candidate, that base. And my instinct is that if Sanders hadn't run and Martin O'Malley had been the other candidate, he would actually have done not quite as well, because I don't think he'd have done as well getting small donors, but he would probably have got most of that anti-Clinton coalition. But on the other hand, you had a candidate who couldn't appeal to African Americans or to Hispanics, really, in great numbers, apart from, you know, among the young, but not even all millennials, as it were, only kind of the second wave of millennials. My instinct is that she will still win. If she loses, it will be because of a differential enthusiasm among Democratic-leaning voters and Republican-leaning voters, right? It feels to me unlikely, and the assumption feels fairly problematic, that do we think that white liberals don't care enough about stopping Trump to vote for the candidate they don't want, but black Americans would have done that? That doesn't feel likely. It kind of feels to me that my instinct, yeah, my hostage to fortune, is I tweeted at one point in the primaries, I don't think either of them are that great, but I think both of them would beat Trump, right?
I think the other differential that didn't get discussed enough was the idea that actually there's all this dirt to throw against Clinton, and actually, do you know what? The Republican Party didn't do a huge amount of oppo on Sanders because they didn't think he was going to win, right? And this is the same thing I think that some Jeremy Corbyn supporters are going to discover when we get to the next general election campaign, that actually, you know, when someone comes out to really try and destroy you, they will probably bring up stuff that you kind of, you know, that, you know, if somebody hasn't been destroyed yet, it doesn't mean they can't be destroyed later, if you see what I mean. And I think actually there weren't those kind of incredibly heavy attacks on some of the Sanders voting record, because they just sort of they kept their powder dry for that, right? I think Hillary Clinton had been a much more scrutinized candidate. There was a lot more out there about her that people could feel polarized about.
Well, things we also have absolutely no idea what would have happened to Sanders's numbers if it was the slightly odd thing about the 2016 primary is he got very, very heated among a lot of activists, and some of the campaign teams got very annoyed with each other, and there were lots of fairly uncharitable things emailed about Bernie Sanders by members of the DNC. But actually, in terms of the ads they ran against each other,
It was
in many ways a less aggressive primary than
2008. Well, 2008, you did have Hillary sort of slightly implying that, you know, can we trust this guy? He's a bit, oh,
yeah.
And then that breach sewed itself up again, and she served it as his Secretary of State. So yeah, I know what you mean. It wasn't unlike the Republican primary, full of people saying unforgivable things about each other, that mean that they would never be able to serve.
Yeah, but,
together.
But my instinct is, yeah, and I say this, you know, my full disclosure, I still don't think that she will lose. I can see how there's a chance that she'll lose, but it just doesn't feel very likely. We know there is a reservoir of white, no degree. I'm going to forget what the US equivalent of a GCSE qualification, but they don't have post GCSE qualifications who didn't vote in 2012 and 2008. Right, there is a reservoir of voters that can be tapped into, whereas the Obama coalition of minorities and graduates is basically tapped out. However, there's no evidence in terms of ballot registration that Trump is motivating those people. He tended to underperform his polling in the primaries because he didn't have and still doesn't have a very effective ground organization. So my instinct is it would have been fine regardless. If it's not fine, it basically feels the Democrats would have swapped one enthusiasm problem for another.
Yeah.
And I'm not convinced. But yeah, the interesting thing is, of course, whatever happens, a large part of this result will be because people are voting for Obama's third term. The interesting question is what happens
when they can't get Obama's fourth term.
Yeah, because it's one thing to be elected on Obama's coattails in 2016. It's fairly hard to do that in 2020.
Okay, I hope that answered. I hope that wasn't too rambling, but do send us in more questions if you liked it. We always love talking about the US election, so I'll just let Stephen die quietly in the corner.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast, presented by me, Helen Lewis, and produced by Anna Leskovitz. You can find us every week at newstatesman.com/podcast or on iTunes. Our theme music is Devil with the Devil by the Underscore Orchestra, licensed under Creative Commons.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.